The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 223, a paper entitled The Apostle Paul, the Submission of Women, the Husband as Household Head, and Slavery. The presenter is Carrie Mills. The respondent is Mary Ellen Robertson.
Good morning. I think it's 10 o'clock and time for us to start. You have wandered into session 223, a paper entitled The Apostle Paul, The Submission of Women, the Husband as Household Head, and Slavery. Interesting topic for us to explore today. Our presenter is Carrie Miles, who's a senior research fellow at the Consortium for Study of Religion, Economics, and Culture, Georgia Mason University. She's also an author of a forthcoming book, The Redemption of Love. And her paper will be responded to by Mary Ellen Robertson. She's a woman studies and religion at Claremont Graduate University and a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. So I'll turn the time over first to Carrie and then to Mary Ellen, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Rebecca. I was startled one morning when my clock radio came on to National Public Radio, and they had the author of a new book on the Apostle Paul on the talk show. And as the radio came on, he was saying, Paul never saw a status quo he didn't like. And this reflects Paul's reputation, the Apostle Paul, author of most of the New Testament. Paul has this reputation for supporting the ancient status quo of patriarchy. And a lot of this reputation comes from the passage that I'm going to be talking about today in Ephesians 5, 21 to 6, 9. And Paul is perceived as being very anti-woman and also being supportive of slavery. His passages were the ones that were used in the American South, before the Civil War to justify the institution of slavery. And his reputation comes from parallels between what scholars perceive as what scholars perceive as parallels between his writings, especially in this passage in Ephesians, and ancient household codes that were written by moralists such as Plutarch. And in these household codes, they would address the duties of the various members of the households, the duties of the slaves, the children, and the wives, relative to the duties of the master, husband, father. Okay? So some scholars see Ephesians 5 and 6 as Paul's attempt to mirror these codes and thus assure secular Roman authorities who were viewing this little Christian movement with a great deal of suspicion that they were actually very respectable and supportive of Roman morality. And this passage is the source of the infamous wives be subject to your husbands, and also more I'll read to you in a minute about slaves obeying their masters and serve them with a willing heart and so forth. And these passages, actually, if you read them in this context, they sound as if Paul really does approve of slavery and the status quo in the family. And my thesis in this paper and in my forthcoming book, The Redemption of Love, is that far from advocating the status quo of patriarchy, Paul was seeking, like Jesus, to overturn it, to overthrow it entirely. And if he paralleled the Greco-Roman household code at all, it was in order to stand it on its head. So to understand where I'm coming from, to look at these New Testament's remark about power relationships within the family, both Jesus in Matthew 19 and Paul tell us that we have to go all the way back to the beginning to understand God's true intent for human beings when he created us, especially when he created us as male and female. And then we look at this creation account to tell us why we no longer live according to that ideal. So in the creation account, in Genesis 1 and 2, these are passages that both Jesus and Paul quote, is that for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Okay, so this is the ideal. Relationship that's set out in Genesis 1 and 2. Also, creation tells us that after God made humankind as male and female, God blessed them, fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And you'll notice that there's no gender-specific responsibilities given in creation. These are not commandments, by the way, but they're blessings, sort of like, you know, the, how did they do it? The Vulcans live long and prosper. You know, that's not a commandment. It's an imperative, but it's an imperative of blessing. So this is a similar sort of thing. So God blesses them with... with children and with dominion over the earth, but these are given to both the man and the woman. So he doesn't turn aside and say, women, you're going to take care of the kids, and men, you're going to rule the earth. Okay. However, shortly after this one flesh statement, we have Genesis 3, which accounts the fall. Okay, so... we have the ideal where man and woman are interacting with God every day, walking in his presence in the garden, no cares or responsibilities. And then we have the fall, and after they partake of the forbidden fruit, you have what's described as a curse in Genesis 3. And God next describes what mortality will involve. They'll have children. They'll be driven from the garden. And the ground will be cursed, and it's going to bring forth thorns. So from now on, they're going to have to work very hard. Men will be driven by the need to control their environment and to get status and power over each other. Women will become subordinate to the man in the process of the struggle. And in the end, they're both going to die anyway. Now, basically what my book is arguing is that God creates us for this ideal. There's all of these things that happen as a result of the fall and the curse on the ground. If you look carefully at Genesis 3, you see that God cursed. There's only two curses pronounced in there. One's on the serpent and then the other is on the ground. Henceforth, it will bring forth thorns because you've done this thing. And that the whole purpose of Christian, well, not the whole purpose, there's other things going on there too. But one of the big things that God is trying to do through Jesus Christ and the atonement is to bring us back to the creation ideal. Okay, so let's get a little cultural background on the world that Jesus was preaching to and that Paul was writing to. Jesus Christ was born to reconcile us to God and to lead us back into the garden, and it's probably no coincidence that he came when he did. The 100 years or so before his birth, the Roman Empire had conquered the entire known world, including Palestine, the area of Jerusalem where Jesus and Paul were living. And in a world where the acquisition of power and control in order to survive, like with the cursed ground, where this was important, Rome was wildly successful. If there's ever been the definition of patriarchy, it was probably Rome. A class called patricians. These were wealthy men who controlled everyone, and they were the ones who ruled Rome. And our word family comes from the Latin word that referred to these men's households. And this didn't include just their family, not just their wives and their children, and maybe, you know, any other relatives that are hanging on, but also and mostly their slaves. Okay, so family referred to a wealthy man's entire household, especially his slaves. About a third of the population that lived in the Mediterranean Roman cities were enslaved. another third were former slaves. So slavery was a very dominant aspect of life in Rome. And patriarchy, as Scott Barchi, I don't know if you've heard any of his talks at Sunstone, has said, makes a very good point, that we usually think of patriarchy as this domination of women by men. Patriarchy was actually the domination of a few men of everybody else. And other men, the vast majority of men, were also the victims of patriarchy as much as women were. Okay, so in the Roman world, whether you were a slave or a child or the wife of a family, it was explicit in Roman law that everyone existed only to serve the master of the house. And there was these very, the citizen class was, I think, maybe 5 or 10% of the Roman population, maybe not even that much, maybe 3 or 4. So as you can imagine, the marital relationship suffered in this world. The people to whom Paul were writing, and Paul was writing to, he was the apostle to the Gentiles, right? So he's writing to these mixed Greco-Roman, various ethnic groups, some Jews, that lived in the Asia Minor area and Roman area. The people to whom Paul were writing had likely not gotten married because they loved each other or probably had no concept at all of romantic love. They had probably not even chosen each other, but rather anyone with property had an arranged marriage. And marriage was just kind of part of the business. The fathers arranged marriage just to further their own economic agendas and their own political agendas. And the feelings of the bride and the groom were considered pretty much irrelevant. The sons in a Roman household were expected to serve their father as long as he lived. So instead of the creation ideal, which is a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, in a typical Roman marriage, a very young girl, and the average Roman bride was maybe 12, and they were married as young as 8, because they had a real shortage of women. They killed off most of them. A very young girl was shipped off to a family of a man maybe 20 years older than her, because the men didn't marry until their late 20s or early 30s. And instead of the husband being joined to his wife, the husband's allegiance still belonged to his family and siblings, and the wife was hardly even considered a member of the family until she produced a male heir. And over time, husbands and wives might come to care for each other, but they did not expect to be close emotionally. And Barchi talks about how in this kind of environment, if you needed an emotional confidant, you would go to your sibling, someone in your family, and not this strange little girl who's brought in to bear you legitimate children. And eventually, she's going to take over the household management. But it's a different notion of marriage at that time. So the question now is that when you read Paul, which camp does he belong in? Does he belong in the restoring us to the ideal of marriage, or is he subscribing to this very Roman, patriarchal, fallen sort of notion of the relationship within the family? Okay, so phrased this way, then we're going to start looking at the text now, and I think it's going to be pretty apparent just what Paul did stand for. I have some copies. Okay, now if you had a copy of the Bible in front of you, you would see that the one that causes all the problems for us is Ephesians 22. I don't know, women, how you feel when you read this, wives, be subject to your own husbands as unto the Lord, and be, as a husband, as Jesus is the head of the church, so is the husband, is the head of the wife. And so wives should be subject to their husbands in everything. How do you feel when you read that? Anybody? Well, I know my own response is if you read just that passage, you kind of feel like you've been punched in the gut. Anyone else share that? Okay. And if you read your Bibles, there'll be a little heading that says wives submission or something like that. And then it will start with verse 22 and it will say, wives, be subject to your husbands. Okay. This passage starts earlier than that. Those little headings were not you know, Paul didn't write those little headings in the Bible. In fact, the if you look at old Greek texts of the New Testament, they had no punctuation. They didn't even put space between words. Papyrus was cheap, but parchment, which is the stuff that survived, was very expensive. So they would write, you know, just one continuous line of letters from one edge of the page to the other. So these breaks were added later. This text actually begins much earlier, but I'm going to go back to 20. And this reads, he's talking about the congregations praising God always and for everything, giving thanks in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God the Father, being subject to each other in awe of Christ. And then when we get to wife submission, which is the next verse, it doesn't even have a verb in it in the original. It says, wives to your husbands as unto the Lord. But right now, let's just stick with subject, because that is a significant stumbling block for modern English readers in understanding this text. Submission and submissive have bad connotations in English. What connotations does to be a submissive person, submissive personality, to be subject to somebody else? What does that mean in English? Weakness. Passive. Ignore your own interests. I'm going to repeat this for the tape. So.
Powerless.
Powerless.
Let yourself be dominated.
Okay, very much submission has very bad connotations in English. A submissive person is a common person, or he's a follower, someone with no authority, who's given up all hope of authority. One recent book on relationships defines submission as giving into another's control and says that submission comes from a position of weakness. Submission means enduring abusive behavior from your partner because you believe you have no alternatives. And the world also has some, you know, sexual connotations. And it's linked to the notion of accepting mistreatment as to submit to a beating. So this is not regarded as being something that is desirable or something that we want to do. But in Greek, the language in which Paul wrote his letters, the word translated submit or to be subject to lacks these connotations. Okay, it does not even mean to obey. And in fact, obedience has nothing to do with what Paul's asking believers to do. Now, remember, at this point, he's asking everyone to submit to one another as a way of praising God. Okay? It doesn't mean to agree with someone. It doesn't mean to give up your own preferences. And it doesn't even mean to let your husband win at tennis. The root of the word translated be subject to or alternately submit yourself to is hypotasso. And that's the Greek word that's translated as subject or submit. And hypo means to, it means under. So like a hypodermic needle is used to put something under the skin. Okay. And tasso means to locate or place. So the root word means to place under, okay? And it's sometimes translated as put under, all right? Now, when we come across the word subject in English, we tend to understand it in one of two ways. One way is to read it in the active voice. And the active voice of a verb shows the subject of a sentence performing the action of a sentence. So, like, take teach. It's an active verb. I am teaching you about the Greek voice. If I were to subject you, I'd be putting you under my thumb, right? Grinding you down, under my heel, something like that. That's active subject. But in the New Testament, no one is ever instructed to subject anyone else. In fact, Jesus expressly forbade that Christians should ever subject in the active voice anyone else. And he said, you know that those who are supposed to rule over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. Okay? So in Ephesians 5:21, Paul does not mean subject in the active voice. So consciously or not, English readers read it in the passive. Okay? In the passive voice, the subject of the sentence is the one active upon. I am taught Greek. Okay? In the case of submission in the passive, somebody else has us under their thumb or under their heel grinding us down, and I accept the dominion. Now, I am subject to or I am submitting to someone. In English, neither actively subjecting another person or passively accepting subjugation is regarded as healthy or desirable behaviors. But the word used in Ephesians 5 is not in the passive voice either. So Greek has something that English does not, indicated by the endings of the words. And this is a verb form in the middle voice where the subject acts indirectly or directly upon itself. So a middle voice would be like, I teach myself Greek. Okay, so it's the active voice, I teach Greek, the passive voice, I am taught Greek, in the middle voice, I teach myself Greek. And that's what hypotasso is in these passages. And it means to place yourself one another or subject yourself to one another willingly. In instructing Christians to subject themselves to one another, Paul was not urging them to exercise power over anyone or to passively yield to the exercise of power. Rather, he asked Christians to voluntarily place themselves below other people, themselves, which he says in Philippians. They do this not to support the status quo, as some scholars would think, but to perpetuate Jesus' revolutionary teaching that their great men will exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. Okay, in asking Christians to subject themselves to one another, Paul is asking them to opt out of the power struggle in which the whole world was engaged. Okay, the whole Roman world was engaged in a struggle for control and power and honor and status over each other. And Paul is saying, no, that's not important for you. You opt out of that. Okay? And they do this in awe of Christ, because this is what Christ did, continually placing himself below others, taking on the role of a servant while rising triumphant over the concerns of the world. Okay, now to see more easily how Paul's teachings in Ephesians 5 and 6 challenge the family structure of the ancient world, I'm going to start by looking at the most extreme of those power relationships, and that's the master and slave. So we're going to skip down to, Ephesians 6:5, and look at what he's saying to slaves. Slavery, as it was practiced in the Roman world, differed in important ways from its later practice in America. For one thing, Roman slavery was not race-based. They tended to be, historically, they had been peoples that were captured in war. In fact, slaves come from the word for Slavs, because they thought Slavs made good slaves. They capture these people and bring them back and make them work for them. By the time of Christ, most of the slaves had either been born into slavery, or some actually entered slavery more or less voluntarily. You could sell yourself into slavery to pay debts. There were certain important civil positions that could only be held by slaves, so people would sell themselves into slavery to get the job as treasurer of the city, for instance. And some entered slavery simply to escape the grinding poverty that was the lot of most poor people. If you were poor, the free worker in Rome was more likely to be taken advantage of than the slave. But that's not to say that being a slave was a good thing, because they had no control over their bodies. They could be killed and so forth. But any wealthy household consisted mostly of slaves. And it was a kind of fundamental social institution and the basis of most business relationships. So, you know, instead of employer-employee, you had masters and slaves to a great deal. And paradoxically, Paul's writings about slavery were later used in the American South to justify slavery, but if you read these things in context, especially the letter to Philemon, read that someday, that's really pretty amusing. You see the Jewish mother in Paul. This passage is one that is read out of context to justify slavery. But let's look at what he's really saying. Slaves, obey your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in singleness of heart as to Christ, not in the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as slaves of Christ doing the will of God from the soul, with good will serving as slaves to the Lord and not to men, as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he receives the same again from the Lord, whether he's slave or free. Okay, so this looks like he's saying, you know, obey your masters, do what he tells you, work hard for them, and God will reward you for being a good slave. So it seems to support this. But now read the next verse. What is Paul telling masters to do? Do the same to them. What did he just tell the slaves to do? Serve your masters. Not with fear and trembling, but with singleness and heart. He's telling masters to serve their slaves. What does this mean? This makes no sense at all. Okay, he expected them to serve their slaves with a willing heart. He tells them to forbear threatening his slaves. Now, in the Greco-Roman law, masters held this enormous coercive power over their slaves. They weren't just employers, employees, we're all on the same team, we're all trying to accomplish the same goals. A master could execute a slave just summarily. He could just, nobody would come to find out, you know, what had happened to this guy. So he had this enormous coercive and economic power over all members of the household. And slaves did their master's will not because they were all working together, but because they had to. So Paul tells Christian slave owners to give up their coercive power over their slaves. And he says that if God doesn't treat you, the master, as a slave, you're all slaves of God, right? If he doesn't treat you badly, if he doesn't use coercive power over you, then you have to treat these people the same way that God is treating you. All right? So he's saying your status of giving you power over other people, you can't use it as Christians. Okay? So Paul completely changes the orientation of masters towards slaves. Now you might say, well, why didn't Paul tell masters to free their slaves? And he does in Philemon, sort of. He says, well, I could command you, but I'm not going to. But, you know, he gives them this. But you owe me your life, you know. Slavery was, as I said, often this was people's employment. This was where they lived. To tell people to free their slaves would be essentially throwing them out of their home and their employment, you know. They could be freed in this sense of making them into brothers and sisters instead of slaves without having to actually legally manumit them or cast them out of their household. Okay. So he changes the master's orientation towards these people who are working for him, and he changes the slaves' motivations as well. So all of these things that he says to slaves are not telling them to be servile or to be submissive in the passive, pathological sense. Instead, slaves are at the very bottom of the hierarchy in a struggle for control. But in Christ, the world of thorns no longer has a hold on over them, and they no longer have to strive against it. So they obey their masters according to the flesh, who can command their labor, but their fear and trembling and their singleness of eye is for the Lord. Okay, so these passages, Paul's going to say this in addressing wives, slaves, and children, that you're doing this as to the Lord. And some people interpret that as saying that they're supposed to treat the master, father, husband as if he were Jesus. You know? No, he's saying you're doing this now as a service to the Lord rather than because of the coercive power that your master holds over you. Okay. So slaves no longer had to live in fear of their master's coercive power or strive to please men in order to enlarge their own power base, which is the eye service and men-pleasing business is about. Although legally enslaved and owing obedience to their earthly masters, in the spiritual realm they were slaves of Christ. And turning their servitude into an offering to God, they imbibed in faith that he would take care of them in a way that their earthly master could not. The bottom line, Paul told them both, is that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and spiritually the status of slave or free makes no difference. And in fact, in the early Christian congregations, there were lots of slaves. In fact, one of the advisors to the Roman Emperor was asked to make a report on this little Christian movement, and he characterized it as a religion of women, children, and slaves. There were lots of slaves, and most of them probably did not have Christian masters, but the congregations made no distinction between them socially, between enslaved free people, and in fact put them in leadership positions, and the congregations would work, save up money to buy each other out of slavery. Okay, so what Paul says to masters and slaves then is a completely different take on what we usually read this to mean. At first glance, Paul also seems to be accepting the social order regarding children, telling them, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Note that Paul directed that children honor and obey their mothers as well as their fathers. But in the next passage, however, Paul just addresses the fathers, and he says, fathers, do not provoke the anger of your children, but bring them up or nurture them in the admonition and instruction of the Lord. Okay, now in this fallen world, in a pre-industrial economy, a major motive for having children was so that they could serve their fathers, work for them, care for them in their old age, increase the family honor, run the family business, whatever. And under Roman law, fathers held much of the same coercive power over their children that masters exercised over slaves. Fathers could order the abandonment of an unwanted newborn, and that was part of why there were so few women. There were probably 7 women to every 10 men in the Roman Empire because they didn't want to raise girls. They would abandon them. And he could kill a disobedient child. Further, sons, at least those who wanted their inheritance, did not become autonomous just by turning 21 or some other magical age, but they served their father as long as he lived. And daughters, of course, joined their husband's family. So this meant that the fathers had great economic and coercive control over their children, and so what Paul is doing here, when he tells them don't provoke your children to anger or don't exasperate your children, is he's telling fathers to give up their coercive control over their children, just as he did with slaves. So he can't exercise his superior status over his children in order to exploit them. Rather, fathers are to serve their children, using their children's obedience to bring them up in the admonition and instruction of the Lord. So we're switching here from the fallen imperative, which is have children to serve you and to work as farm help and so forth, back to the ideal here where you're having children and you're doing that in order to raise them up as good Christians. It completely changes the orientation for having children. And as with Paul's instructions to slaves and masters, he asks children for a transformation of their attitudes as well, and to obey their parents because it's right and not because they're just kind of biding their time until they get their inheritance. Okay, so they're obeying them in the Lord now rather than because of Roman civil law. Okay, in instructions to masters and slaves, fathers and children, Ephesians 6, 1-9, make it clear that Paul was far from supporting the Roman status quo. It was not so much that Paul subverted the dominant morality as he transcended it. Its categories were simply not to the point anymore. Masters, fathers, slaves, and children stepped out of the power-laden relationship sanctioned by Roman law and submitted to each other, gave up their struggle for power over each other out of awe for Christ, who'd taken on the same submissive role himself, not out of weakness, but was because it was right in God's sight. So now let's return to what Paul says to husbands and wives. Okay. Paul's contemporaries would have been somewhat surprised by what he told fathers and alarmed by what he told slave owners, but they could scarcely imagine what he asked of husbands. In Ephesians 6, Paul asked men to serve those whom society said were subordinate to him, and that was radical enough. But in Ephesians 5, he asked men not only to serve their wives, but to become one of one will and desire with them. Now remember, you've got a teenage girl married to a 30-year-old man, and they're supposed to become one flesh. Right? Okay, so let's back up then and go into what he's saying to wives. Addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with all your heart, always and for everything giving thanks in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God the Father, be subject to yourself out of respect for Christ, Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord. Okay, so this injunction to wives is not a freestanding commandment. It doesn't even have a verb in the Greek. But it's a tag on to be subject to each other. Okay? So wives are just part of the people who are going to be subjecting, opting out of that power struggle. Okay? And they're also submitting out of respect for Christ. And then it goes on, for the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, himself the Savior of the body. But as the church submits to Christ, so also wives in everything to their husbands. And again, there's no verb for the wives there in 24. Okay, so you can see here now that he's going to ask slaves and masters and fathers and children to stop this struggle for power over each other, that what he's saying to wives is a similar sort of thing. He's saying, don't engage in the struggle to power. Roman women didn't have a lot of power. Well, they had, actually, if they had backings from their father, they did have a fair amount of independence. But the only way they had any power over their husbands was manipulation, being kind of sexy and trying to get their way like that. So Paul's telling them not to engage in that power struggle either. But another word he uses here also throws modern readers off track. What word would that be? Okay, head. The husband is the head of the wife. That has a lot of meaning in contemporary evangelical Christianity today. And the problem with head, kephale is the Greek word here that he uses. And the problem here isn't the problem of mistranslation. It's perfectly translated. It means head. There's no other way to translate it. But the confusion that this word generates is because head has meanings in English that it did not have in ancient Greek. Okay? When an English speaker reads head in this passage, he or she automatically understands it to mean the brains, what else? The authority, the boss. Okay, that like the head of the corporation. Right? Okay, in Greek, Hebrew, the language that the Old Testament's written in, it had that metaphorical meaning. In Greek, it did not. Okay, so where we read this to mean that the man is the boss of the woman, the ruler, the authority over. How we read Paul as wives submit to your husband because he's your ruler just as Christ is the ruler of the church. But kephale cannot be translated as boss or ruler or even as servant leader because while head can mean authority in English, it didn't have that connotation in Greek at the time that Paul wrote the letters to the Ephesians. There was another word for ruler or someone who had the right to tell others what to do, and that was arche. And they refer to, I think, Herod as being the archon of Palestine at the time of Christ. Okay, so that comes from that word. And this is the word that meant authority over. And if Paul meant that the husband was the ruler of his wife or that Christ was the ruler of the church, he would certainly have used arche or perhaps kyrios, which means Lord, or despotis, which is translated as lord or head of the household, instead of kephale. I mean, Paul knew all these languages, and he knew exactly what he was using here. So further, authority over makes no sense in the context of the rest of the instructions to the husbands. In the next few verses, 25 to 33, Paul draws a series of parallels between Christ's expression of love for the church and a husband's expression of love for his wife, and as we'll see, that none of these have anything to do with authority or rule. Okay? So if Paul didn't mean to be making a statement about power or authority relationships between men and women, just what did he mean by calling man the head of the wife? As one Greek scholar points out, he doesn't think that Paul meant authority over, as the traditionalists assert, nor source, as the egalitarians assert. He said, I think he's merely employing a head-body metaphor. Okay? So you're going to have head, body, and together they're one flesh. Okay? And the original readers of Ephesians would have understood what Paul meant by the use of this head-body metaphor because he's been using it throughout Ephesians. In the opening sentences of the letter, Paul told his reader that God's purpose was to unite or bring together all things in heaven and earth in Christ. And the word that's translated unite or bring together is literally head up. It's bringing several things together under one head. Okay, so the sense of head is as uniting, integrating, and nurturing the body. And that's explicit throughout Ephesians. Okay, he also said we're to grow up in every way unto Christ, who is head, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by every joint in which is supplied, with which it is supplied, when each part is working properly, makes bodily upgrowth and builds itself in love. And I think Ephesians 1:23 is particularly useful in understanding Paul's true attitude about the power relationships between the head and the body. And here he says, God has put all things under Christ's feet, and is made in the head over all things for the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills it all in all. Okay? So this passage makes it clear that the relationship between the head and the body is not one of dominance and subordination. Okay? He's put all things under Christ's feet. This is hypotasso here. He has subjected everything to Christ. But the things are not put under the head, they're put under the feet, okay? Below the entire body. I'll read that again. God has put all things under Christ's feet and has made him the head over all things for the church, which is his body, and also his feet, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So the head does not subject the body, but reigns together with it. And he says, for all things are yours, and you are Christ, and Christ is God's. And Ephesians 5:23 equates Christ's headship with his role as Savior, and this was a notion of someone who provides great benefit. And so the Greco-Roman world would honor people as saviors who'd like saved a city that was under siege or something like this. So for the husband to be the head of the wife in the same sense that Christ is the head of the church, he does not rule or even lead her, but is instead the one who facilitates their unity, growth, and upbuilding in love. He's the one who leads the way to this one flesh union. And there's more to say about wifely submission, but I don't know if I'm going to have time to say it. But anyway, if you read 25 to 33, where Paul's addressing husbands, he's elaborating on their role as head by continuing to draw on this analogy between Christ's unity with the church and the marriage relationship. And he asks husbands to do a lot of things which sound really beautiful but abstract. But these are not meaningless like Valentine's Day sentiments, but a thorough revamping of the traditional male role. He asks men to love their wives. Now, this isn't like a marriage encounter going rekindle the romantic spark. This is agape love. Have caring concerns for your wife as Christ loved the church. He's asking them to give themselves up for their wives, like as Christ gave himself up to the church. Does that mean he wants men to die for their wives? That's a very romantic concept, isn't it? But no, he's probably talking about giving up having to be the boss, giving up this power and status relationship that men held over women. Which was probably harder than dying for their wives. It might have been easier to give up, to die for your wives than to give up having your own way. To make her glorious and holy by washing of the water of the word. It doesn't mean you take showers together, but help your wife be the best she can be. You know, don't compete with her. Husbands are to love their wives as they love their own bodies. Husbands are to treat their wives with the same respect that they have for themselves. And just as a person knows when a part of his body is injured or in need, a husband should be aware of his wife's needs and treat her pain as urgently as he would his own. Paul uses the words nourish and cherish, continuing the head-body metaphor. You know, you feed your own body, you take care of your own body. And, you know, nourishing and cherishing were not guy things. Most men were well-trained not to express any emotion, and I think they probably still are. So he's really asking men to step out of this patriarchal role there. And then he ends with this reference back to creation. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will be one flesh. And again, this was another threat to the ancient patriarchal order, which said that an adult son's loyalty was always to his family of origin, and his wife was kind of viewed with suspicion because she was coming from another family. Okay, so Paul is saying, no, not this, but this. Okay. And finally, Paul sums up his address to wives and husbands in verse 33. Each of you should love his wife as himself, and a wife should respect her husband. In reading Ephesians 5, Paul often asks why it is that people often ask why it is that husbands get to love, which is kind of exciting, not always pleasant. They get to love their wives, and a wife has to respect her husband. Okay, so why does Paul designate the husband and not the wife as the head? As long as we're asking these hard questions. Okay, why isn't man the body and woman the head? Perhaps this is because the things that Paul asked husbands to do, to love as they love their own selves, to help someone else be the best they could be, to nurture, to serve, and cherish, these were feminine roles. Okay, service was expected of wives and mothers. A wife might not love her husband romantically, but caring concern was her job. And a woman's self-sacrifice had no particular Christian meaning because even the pagans expected her to devote herself to her husbands and children's. So why should wives respect their husbands? Because he was giving them this long list of really hard things to do, things that went against their role and everything they'd been taught to be as a man or to expect as a man. Even poor men expected women would serve him and be subordinate to him. And how would it be if men made these sacrifices and their wife didn't respect them, did not let them off the hook of this fallen world patriarchal order, started treating the servants like they were brothers. I think, you know, if a woman was not herself redeemed, she would find that very threatening. A woman might not like living with a dominant, aggressive man, but he's the one who made the money. He's the one who had the power. He's the one who lifted her status in society. So when Paul is telling wives to respect their husbands, it's to let him be what God is telling him he has to be. Okay? And I think this is also why the husband is designated as the head. Another metaphorical meaning of head in Greek was to be, it was the head of the army. Not the head of the general or the one in leadership, but the first in the battle. And I think that's what Paul is asking men to be here, is the one to lead the way into battle in this accepting redemption into their relationship and bringing the household back into the original ideal of one flesh where they're sharing the blessings of children and dominion over the earth. Okay, and I'm sorry I went so long.
I asked to be the respondent to this paper because I knew it would be a challenge to my long-held assumptions about Paul and what kind of person and leader and speaker he was. I'm sure I might have some company in that in the audience today. Plus, it was kind of a hard sell for me to see him in a different light after years of having, you know, my colleagues in young men or singles wards or seminary classes quoting Paul as a weapon to either shut up the girls in the class or you know, try to get a rise out of the female population. So I kind of have a bad attitude toward Paul. At the same time, if I step back, I realized that, you know, he also said some things that were beautiful and uplifting and spiritually motivating, and so I can't entirely dismiss him for some of the dunderheaded things that he said. even though sometimes I tend to be over-focused on those dunderheaded things. But in reading this paper and working up a response to it, the value I saw in having to stretch myself and my own ideas this way was that there is value to getting under the surface of things and seeing what else might be true about this figure, this writer, and the things that he had to say. I think it's pretty clear that we're dealing with a very complex person in Paul, and that we may not know everything there is to know about him or the things that he said. So I tried to approach it with an open mind, but I definitely had some biases going in. And I appreciate all the excavation that Carrie's done to raise some of these issues and bring them to the surface and see beyond the surface of what Paul had to say. I do see some obstacles to this new view of Paul gaining a wider audience, and especially in the Mormon community, where our religious education amounts to maybe a few years of seminary, dozing off through Sunday school class, sacrament meeting talks, things like that. We're definitely instructed not to go to outside sources for more information. So I think these things can kind of limit how accessible new ideas are to the Mormon population. And if Paul, one of the things I wondered about was, if Paul was so radically trying to undermine the patriarchal status quo rather than support it, as we might assume with a quick reading, why do so few scholars and readers pick up on that? And why does the face value of what he has to say seem to get far more airplay than the ideas that Carrie's laid out? And one of the other things that I kind of wondered about was, if Paul isn't the jerk that we might have thought he was, I just find it curious that a woman scholar is pointing this out. You'd think that, with all the generations of male religious scholars, they would be trying to redeem Paul if he was really so sullied in his reputation by the things that he said. And if he was translated so incorrectly, why aren't the men folks saying, well, he was so mistranslated? And I think I have some ideas about that, gleaned from a book that I really enjoy called When Women Were Priests. And this particular scholar goes through and talks about, the leadership roles that women actually had in early Christianity. And in one passage, she's talking about kind of the assumptions of there are far more people than Paul saying negative things about women and belittling their capabilities. And so one of the things that stood out to me was this passage here, and I'll try to read through it quickly. Modern church scholars have invariably assumed that the condemnation of women's leadership by these ancient Christian writers was based on theological arguments. When Tertullian and his ilk bar women from teaching and baptizing, scholars have tended to see divine, and therefore unassailable, justification behind it. But such interpretations are guilty of a serious oversight. They fail to take into account the enormous extent to which the Christian church allowed Greco-Roman social dogma to pervade its teachings, in this case, the secular circumscriptions on women's activities. They have also somehow missed an important implication in these ancient denunciations, that women actually held significant positions of leadership in the churches. Otherwise, there would be no need for these fulminations, which convey the unmistakable tone of threatened authority. So I think that illuminates some of the tensions of what was going on, where some of these pronouncements against women's full participation came from, and what was really underneath some of those, someone trying to cover their ass and stay in the power seat. And I think, too, if this setup, if what Paul is asking us to do is something different than we've assumed, if he was asking his early followers to give up power, to shift the social, familial, and marital dynamics completely and fly in the face of all the familiar social norms, which by any account would be extraordinarily costly to do. Isn't that still true today? Is it any easier for us to relinquish power in our relationships? Are we any more willing to give up our superior status where we might have it, or the privileges that we enjoy because of it, in order to more closely emulate the example of Christ? You know, we claim to be Christians, we claim to be following this figure, and yet we have such difficulty in actually doing that. And especially when, you know, these new ideas come to the surface and we see that, you know, what Paul and what Christ, you know, were asking of us as believers is far more demanding than we can, you know. I think you really have to stop and think about what was being asked of the early Christian church and what's being asked of us as well to follow these examples. You know, it's really hard to serve, you know, in some cases, rather than coerce or to insist on getting your own way. It's difficult to become, you know, to have one will and one desire with your partner, you know, your partner in any endeavor. And, you know, the admonition to become one flesh, if that was easy, there wouldn't be so many self-help books trying to tell us how to do that, right? So I think I'm willing to entertain the idea that Paul was misquoted and that maybe my assumptions about him based on the surface of what he said, maybe my assumptions and my feelings are wrong. But I also think that perhaps our continued misreading of Paul also serves a purpose in that it would allow us to avoid the very stringent demands that he places on us as Christians and believers to actually follow Christ in the ways that both Christ and Paul have outlined for us. Thank you.
Our thanks to Carrie for this careful analysis of really troublesome passages for us. I think I've got questions for you, but we don't have time, and I'm sure others do as well. Context is everything. Learning languages, learning a little history, learning grammar. Terribly, terribly important. And thank you, Mary Ellen, for your contributions as well. I'm sure they're both available to you if you have time to talk with them alone, but we need to end this session. Thank you for your attention and your participation.